It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's a newspaper that gets it. Never has America been so food-obsessed, yet newspapers are slashing their food sections right and left, except at the San Francisco Chronicle. Think 3 days of local coverage and 10 languages. We meet executive food and wine editor Michael Bauer. Well, the Stearns have found soul food spaghetti at Ramon's in Clarksdale, Mississippi. Wine goddess Andrea Immer talks which glass, how cold, and the destiny of that open bottle. Have you tasted wattle seed yet? Well, it's Australia's answer to chocolate on a bush. Just one find of spice hunter Nirmala Nareen. Then it's the healing foods pyramid with chocolate and wine. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. You know, the local food page is something we take for granted, but if you look closely, most of them are disappearing across the country. Yet a handful of newspapers are booming, like the San Francisco Chronicle. Well, we talk with food editor Michael Bauer to get their story. The Minerva of Wine, Andrea Immer, talks the essentials, a practical take on the ideal wine glass, the ideal temperature, and what to do with that open bottle, aside from finishing it off. Nirmala Nareen is what I call an anthropological spice hunter. She goes to native peoples and is wise enough to let them be her teachers. And in the process, she's collected a new world of seasonings. Product first, customer second. The mission statement of one of the new wave of micro coffee roasters. Food writer Francine Maroukian has the story and the picks. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we were just in Clarksdale, Mississippi, which is in the Delta, and is without a doubt one of the most fascinating towns that you could ever visit. And we ate at a place called Ramon's, which as many times we've been to Clarksdale, we have never been there. And I don't know how we missed it.
I know how we missed it.
How?
Because it's in a residential neighborhood. It looks like a dump. We could have driven past it and said, ugh, who would ever want to eat there? However, we were in a store in downtown Clarksdale called Cathead Blues and Folk Art, a source for any obscure recordings or books about Delta life or folk art made there. And the proprietor, Roger Stolle, who we've known for a while, said, you know, if you guys want a really great meal in Clarksdale, meet me and my wife, Jennifer, for dinner tonight at Ramon's. Well, we did. Roger had warned us. He said, now, don't be put off by the way it looks. And if you go inside, don't look at the ceiling because it's caving in. However, he said, now get this. He said, the specialty of the house is irresistible. The specialty of the house is spaghetti and chicken livers. Now, we couldn't resist. So we met him and his wife for dinner there that night and had not only great spaghetti and chicken livers, but some of the best butterfly fried shrimp I've eaten anywhere.
I know you're an expert on Italian food, but I have to say that spaghetti in Mississippi is certainly unlike any spaghetti in Italy, but it's soul food spaghetti, which means that it is the opposite of al dente, big sort of soft, mushy noodles in kind of like barbecue sauce. And I'm sure, Lynn, you would run screaming from it and hate it. But, you know, in the context of where you are, it works.
I have to say, it doesn't sound too bad.
No, and, you know, the soft, soft noodles go so well with the crunchy fried chicken livers that are on the side. It's just a wonderful, kind of unexpected combination. I also have to mention that, in fact, the dumpiness of this place, it really has a charm all of its own. The story Roger told us is that the landlord of this restaurant has no incentive to maintain it because the rent the people that run it pay is so low. So that's why it's falling apart. However, the people who run it have made a great effort to try and make it charming by putting in decor that consists of lamps made from empty bottles of Jack Daniel's and Gallo wine. On top of which they've
got 3-liter jugs of Taylor Chablis.
Taylor Chablis, that's correct, Jane. And, you know, they put like bulbs above that and these sort of tacky lampshades. And there's a certain, I don't know what you want to call it, primitive charm about this that goes really well with the food.
You know what? It sounds like the kind of place I'm always looking for.
Well, next time we meet up on the road, Lynn, we have to go to Ramon's.
It's you way off the beaten path.
And I'll leave the Rosetto at the door.
Yeah, okay. Please. And the risotto.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me. Not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me. Not way over. see.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guide, Road Food. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Each week, we send you a quick worknight supper recipe. This week, by the way, it's a steak salad with hot tomato basil dressing. And we've got shopping and technique tips. But best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up, you know where, splendidtable.org. Master sommelier Andrea Immer has a modern take on wine. She's the author of Everyday Dining with Wine and is someone who constantly assesses the basics. The perfect person for us to talk to about those questions that nag you about everyday wine drinking. Andrea, welcome.
Hey, great to be back. Thank you.
You know, I'd like to clear up some basic questions. These are the kinds of things everybody wants to know, and I figure you're the one to answer them. For instance, what's the last word on glassware in terms of wine?
Sure. Wine glassware, I think there's so many choices out there that now people are more overwhelmed than helped sometimes because they're like, am I getting this wrong or what? So there are a couple of basics. First of all, it's fun if you have all the storage space in the world and money to have a wide array of glasses if you really love wine. If you're like most people and you don't and you just want to enjoy wine, even if it's on an everyday basis, you don't need a whole array of glasses. You just need a good basic all-purpose stem. And the characteristics of that are real simple. You want it to have ample capacity. So I think 12.5 ounces or more, but not to the point of being so huge. And the reason for that is not because you're going to pour a 12-ounce glass of wine, which is a lot, but because you're going to fill it half full. And you want all that extra headspace to enjoy the aromas. And that's where they collect, is in open space in the glass. Then you want a stem that is not too tall. Why? Because you're going to stick it in the dishwasher and you know it. So if you have a long stem, it's going to break. And also they can be top heavy if they have a long stem and can topple more easily. Then you want a narrow rim. And what I mean by that is not the jelly jar lip at the the rim of the glass where you drink from. And the reason for that is when you sip, if it has a jelly jar type lip on it, you are going to...
A thick lip.
A thick one, exactly. You're going to suck in rather than pouring the wine into your mouth. And when you pour the wine into your mouth, then you can breathe as you do it. And all of the aromas will sort of process through your olfactory sense and really give you the flavor and the fragrance of the wine. If you suck in and go as you're sipping, all of that aromatic is going to go straight down into your lungs where you can't smell anything.
Yeah.
And so you miss a lot. So those are the characteristics that you want. And it can be glass, it can be crystal. There are excellent glass versions of top quality wine stems so that if you do break them, you don't feel like it, you've ruined your day.
Flare? Or sort of oval-shaped or tulip-shaped?
You can go either way. A tulip shape is a great all-purpose shape. That's what I use at home. I don't necessarily like it to flare out at the top because I want to channel those aromas towards my nose where I can really appreciate them. But you can also go with more of a globe shape, rounded bowl, rather than a tulip, and that works just fine, too.
What about temperature?
Temperature is, to a degree, it's a matter of taste. So if there's a particular way you like your wine, and you know this brings it right down to some people want to put an ice cube in it, that's fine. But there are some temperature guidelines that'll really help you appreciate various wine styles to the fullest. Now, cellar temperature is 55 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you pull a bottle of red wine out at cellar temperature, 55, for some people that's too cool. And I have my sommelier friends in restaurants tell me this all the time. They serve a wine at cellar temperature and the guest says, wow, you know, can you warm that up? And, you know, that doesn't mean go stick it in the microwave. What it really means is just let it sit out for a while. Or sometimes in a pinch, people have even, you know, put the bottle in a warm water bath for a few seconds to heat it up, but just get it in the glass and it'll come to temperature quickly. So more likely, I think most people would enjoy red at a cool room temperature, which is, you know, closer to the low 60s. For white wine, you want something closer to 40, 45 degrees, and especially on the lower end of that for sparkling wine or champagne, because there you really want it to be nice and cool, because that helps to mute the bubbles and keep the wine from going flat quickly. And also it enhances the refreshment factor in a sparkling wine, which is, you know, a lot of what you're going for with that texture and that liveliness of the bubble. It's really refreshing, and the cooler the better in that case.
Oh, yeah. What about the best way to keep an open bottle?
Keeping an open bottle, I'm faced with this all the time at my house, because we're always tasting multiple wines when we cook, and basically to see what goes with what, and just to kind of keep up with the market. What I encourage everyone to do that, by the way. I think most people are like, once I open a bottle, I'm committed. I've got to finish it or it'll go bad.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily have to.
You don't. In fact, having worked for years in restaurants where you serve wine by the glass, and I'm always concerned that the next day I want that, you know, those last two glasses to be as good as the first two were the night before, we would taste the wines the next day to make sure that they're okay. Sometimes they actually get better. So first thing is take a big sigh and feel confident and relieved that the wine isn't going to just tank on you immediately. The best way to preserve it so that you can enjoy it over several days or even up to a week, depending on the style, is to recork the bottle with its original cork and put it in the refrigerator, regardless of color, red or white. Just like anything else that you want to not spoil quickly, if you put it in the fridge, it'll help preserve it. You can also use those vacuum hand pump gadgets that you can get in houseware stores and wine shops. And those, I found over the years, there's a lot of controversy in the trade, but I found over the years that they do add to the life of the wine.
And they pull out that air. They actually create a vacuum.
They pull out the air and create a vacuum so that you don't have as much oxidation going on. What's happening that's causing the wine to first evolve in possibly in a positive way and then ultimately to decline is oxidation. So it's a good thing up to a point, just like when you pull, you know, some brie out of the refrigerator and let it sit at room temperature for a while and then it tastes better than when it came right from the fridge. Sometimes with a little bit of oxidation, the wines will taste better. So you'll open a Chianti, for example, from Italy, and it'll actually taste better the next day or the next or even the next.
Andrea, thank you.
Pleasure.
Master of Wine Andrea Immer's latest project is her DVD, Andrea's Complete Wine Course for Everyone. Coming up, the food section to die for, coffee roasters to know and love, and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Strange happenings are afoot. I mean, we have a booming national fascination with food, yet the newspaper food section in most towns is dying. I mean, it's down to a mass of ads with a few recipe columns off the wire, kind of wedged in. Local coverage is nil because there's no budget. Even the title food is banished in favor of lifestyle. Well, one of the papers that gets what's really happening in America is the San Francisco Chronicle. They cover food, wine, and eating out big time from Wednesday to Sunday. The Chronicle's award-winning executive food and wine editor and its restaurant critic is Michael Bauer. Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Michael, is the food section obsolete?
No, I don't think so. I think that maybe some of our management is obsolete for not seeing the value in the food section. Because I think if you're looking for a section that connects with readers, which is kind of what we say the internet does, the food sections do it. And I think we're really missing the boat.
So you're saying that the food section essentially is the place where people feel they really interact with the newspaper?
Yeah, I mean, it's the cultural, you know, hotspot in everyone's lives. We have more and more cities filled with ethnic communities, and through food you can really get to that audience. And I don't think we're doing it.
Huh. Well, what do you see as your job and the section's job in the San Francisco Chronicle?
Well, we actually have a two-part section. We have food on Wednesday and then wine on Thursday. And I do think our job is to try and bring in as many readers as possible. About 3 years ago, we hired Olivia Wu, who I know you've had on your show before.
Right.
And she really connected with the readers. We got, you know, dozens of emails from and letters from readers who said that she connected them with their Asian past. And we're talking second and third generation people. And I think food can do that better than any other subject.
So because you're in such a vast area, who is your reader? I mean, you have every ethnic group imaginable there.
It's like many newspaper readers. I think now they're more affluent, they're educated, and they do have a wide mix. But I think it's divided by economics. I think you have a much higher income now that are reading newspapers, which is amazing because, you know, 50 years ago it was just the opposite. And so we try and tap into all of that. You know, we do a wide variety of things in the food section. We have a, you know, what's new column. We have a gossip column. We have restaurant reviews. We have a Latino column. We have an Asian column. We have a baking column. We do a weekly Taster's Choice where we have a professional panel taste products. We do a beginner's column, which is called the Chronicle Cooking School.
Mm-hmm.
We have a seasonal cook column. So what we try and do is to try and touch all bases. We have, between us, we speak something like 9 languages. Olivia alone speaks 3 dialects of Chinese and Thai. And we speak Italian, French, Japanese, German. It kind of goes on and on. And that's kind of what we do. We try and have a diversity in ages, in ethnicity, and everything else.
How many people do you have on staff?
Between food and wine, we have 16 people.
The total of 7 papers in the United States.
Yeah, I know. But we also put a big concentration on food. We have food coverage from Wednesday through Sunday in the paper.
That's really covering the waterfront.
And it's all local. That's kind of our mission. 19 years ago when I took over the section, I realized we were using lots of wire and no one was covering, you know, our backyard. So that's really what we do. So everything we do in the food section in particular has a Bay Area base.
What a backyard you've got, though.
Yeah, it's a great backyard.
Well, with 16 staff, tell me what your facility is like.
We have our own building, which is kind of a warehouse-style building. And there we have a wine cellar with a 10,000-bottle capacity. We have a test kitchen, which is located next to my office and the rest of the staff offices. And then on the roof, we have an organic garden that is run, again, by Olivia Wu, who became so fascinated she became a master gardener. And up there we have like 35 kinds of herbs. We have citrus. We have apples, pears. It's an entirely edible garden.
But there must be a huge amount of pressure on you guys from the paper when you have that much square footage given over to this one area. I mean, to produce, right? And to create revenue.
Well, you know, hopefully we do, but I don't feel the pressure of creating revenue. All I do is try and do the best product and hope that that in turn creates revenue.
Hmm. Why do you think San Francisco or the Chronicle is so different from a lot of other papers?
San Francisco, I think it's because we're such a food passionate city, and I can go into, you know, myriad reasons why that happens. I think it's our climate. I think it goes back, my theory is it goes way back to the gold rush. And at that time, it was all mostly men who came out, but there were like houses of prostitution on each corner. And so the way they distinguished themselves was who did the best lunch. And so I think carnal pleasure and food has always been linked in San Francisco. So for 150 years, and that's how we got to where we are today.
New York can't claim
Do
that.
Do you like that theory?
I like that theory a lot. Hey, Michael, thanks.
Thank you, Lynn.
Michael Bauer is executive food and wine editor and restaurant reviewer at the San Francisco Chronicle. Now, Michael left us with a recipe for pomegranate and spice braised pork. Get it on the website, guys, splendidtable.org. You know, when it comes to seasonings, we've gone from a few chilies and maybe lemongrass to an atlas's worth of new spices. And Nirmala Nareen is one of the entrepreneurs who's making this happen. She has got stuff that very few of us have ever heard of. Now, she was born and raised in South America, in Guyana. She was 6 years old when she started cooking for her family of 12. And now she has a spice and food company in New York City, Nirmala's Kitchen. Nirmala, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Nirmala, you have sources for your spices that, I mean, for instance, places I would never think to go, Australia. I mean, who ever thought of Australia as a source for spices? Tell me about just some of the things from there that you bring in.
Well, it's so funny. A couple of years back when I went to Australia, I didn't know what to expect. But one thing I knew for sure is that I had to go and spend time with the Aborigines, and the local tribes started to pour in with all these herbs and spices that they've been using for thousands of years. And what I found, and one of my favorite Australian spices, is wattle seed. And it's from the acacia tree, and it tastes and smells like chocolate and mocha and hazelnut.
Oh, my.
And it's just, it has absolutely no caffeine.
So can you use it in baking and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. I'm like a big fan of creme brulees. I like make creme brulees with everything.
Including wattle seed.
Including wattle seeds. And I make breads and cookies and ice cream and even the leftover grounds. I make this wonderful coconut cookie with oatmeal. And it's really, really, the kids that I teach fourth graders at New York City Public School, and the kids love it.
Talk about your salts, because some of your salts are really unusual.
Well, I found this salt in Oshima Island while I was in Japan, and I decided my salt, you know, there are lots of salts out there, mm-hmm. and I wanted to fuse my salts with ingredients that are indigenous to that region. So my Japanese salt, I'm fusing it with matcha green tea powder, which is a very high-grade green tea powder. And you could put that in soup, salads, rices. And then I have a fleur de sel with pimented espalette from the Basque region of France. And then I fan these Australian pink salt flakes from the Murray River, and I fused it with bush tomato, which is a native Aboriginal spice.
Does bush tomato taste like tomato?
Sort of. It has like a very little bit more citrusy, sort of like with hints of sweetness to it. And they're like these small berries, and it's picked, hand-picked by the natives of the Northern Territory in Australia.
So how many different spices are there that you're carrying at this
point? Oh, gosh. I currently have at least over, I would say close to 100. We'll probably have close to 100 in about 2 or 3 weeks. I have like black limes from Oman, sumac, allspice berries, Peruvian acheto seeds. I have Szechuan peppercorns. I have saffron from Italy, from Kashmir, and from Iran. I have vanilla from Mexico, Papua New Guinea.
My Lord.
Sometimes I can't keep up with all of this. And one of my favorites is long pepper that I brought back from Orissa in India.
What does it taste like? Because that's something you read about in medieval texts.
Well, it's so funny. My mother told me that it's one of the first spices that I tasted as a child because my grandfather was the village Ayurvedic doctor, so he taught me how to fuse spices and do all these different blendings to balance the elements in your body. And so that particular Indian long pepper is a big part of my childhood, growing up with it, cooking with it. And it has, you could use it as you do a black pepper. You could put it in a spice grinder or a pepper grinder, a pepper mill. And I actually make a creme brulee with it, believe it or not.
And you'll make a creme brulee with anything, won't you?
Absolutely. And it's really wonderful. I use it to make ice cream with it. I actually use it to marinate olives with it.
Well, I think that'd be great. Do you think that there is an infinite amount of spices yet to be discovered out there?
Oh, absolutely. There is so much. You know, I get all these food editors are asking me, what else is new? I said, I can't tell you or else I wouldn't be the trendsetter.
You're not revealing your secrets yet.
No, but the key is to look where nobody else is looking. You know, I don't go say, I'm going to go look for this. I want to hunt this now. I let the country and the people come to me. And this way you discover so much more about their history, their tradition, their culture, and most important, their food and their ingredients.
You know, you mentioned Sichuan pepper. Isn't that illegal now to bring
in? No, actually, the FDA just approved it, and so we've been carrying that for a while.
Oh,
and,
that's great.
Yeah, I stay on top of all of that.
I can imagine you would. Yeah. Nirmala, I'm a little jealous about your wonderful trips, but I'm going to take advantage of the spices. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Nirmala Nareen is creator of Nirmala's Kitchen. Now, for information on her spices, go to splendidtable.org. Francine Maroukian is what I think of as a classic food writer. Give her a subject and she will dig until she finds the story. In old newspaper lingo, she covers the waterfront. Now, Francine writes for national publications and is food columnist for Esquire magazine. Francine, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Now, you're working on a coffee story for Travel and Leisure magazine. Can you tell me what it's about?
Well, I've been getting very interested in coffee lately because first of all, I love to drink it, but I think more important about that, I've been noticing that there are small roasters opening up all over the country, and they're returning coffee to the place it used to be before the Second World War. They're bringing coffee back to the neighborhoods. Before the Second World War, almost everyone in America bought their coffee in their own neighborhood.
So are these people who are like small independent business people?
They are, but I don't really know how to describe them yet. Some people call them micro roasters, but I have to say when you're roasting over 1 million pounds of coffee a year, I'm not sure that you're a micro roaster. You might be in terms of, you know, comparing that to a big company like Maxwell House, but 1 million pounds is still a lot of coffee. So I think micro applies to these people in terms of the kind of attention they pay to the coffee. And this means sourcing the bean, it means roasting the bean, it means selling the coffee, and how the coffee is actually made in their cafes.
So where did you go? I mean, where are you finding the most outstanding examples of this?
I have to say they're all over. I chose 4 for very specific reasons. Uh-huh. I chose La Colombe in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I chose Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I chose Intelligentsia in Chicago and Blue Bottle in San Francisco, primarily because they roast in 4 completely different ways and they sell their coffee in completely different ways. And it just goes to show you this is a new business in America, a new old business, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's attracting a lot of counterculture people, very committed people. And I think they represent the sort of 4 main fingers of the trend.
So what are the 4 main fingers?
Well, in Philadelphia, the people from La Colombe, they have a very strange motto. It's an informal motto. I wouldn't call it a logo. It's product first, customer second. They have 4 blends of coffee, which is rare because most people, you know, they have a wider variety.
Mm-hmm.
These guys have 4 blends, and their cafe serves, I think they may have croissant in the morning that they run out of by 10 o'clock. There's no other food. They're committed to their product, and they sell to all the big restaurants in New York. On that philosophy, they say that if they just devote themselves to making the best coffee they can, then the customer benefits as a byproduct of their commitment, which I think is really interesting. And they have a European coffee. It's very luscious and rich. And I think that it's reflected in their cafe, which is very European.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in San Francisco, people like a much darker roast because they've got that Northwest influence. And they also tend to drink their coffee with more milk in it in the Northwest. And so Blue Bottle has darker, I hesitate to use this word because it sounds negative, but an oilier roast.
Mm-hmm.
And these people sell their coffee in a whole different way. They have a kiosk at the Ferry Building, and it's very spontaneous. They grind the coffee while you wait, and they actually have a little saying there, you get what you wait for, which I think is so charming.
Oh, so now what about the other two?
Well, I think what's going on at Zingerman's is very interesting. Zingerman's is a deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Deli is a kind of small word for what it is. It's probably the most important specialty food store in America. It's been there for about 25 years.
Right.
And they have many branches of this business now. They have their own bakery. They make their own cheese. And so it was just a matter of time before they began to make their own coffee. And what I love about the coffee at Zingerman's, aside from the fact that they like to achieve, as they do with other food products, what they call transparency, where they know who grew the bean. And they know who grew the bean, and the customer knows who roasted the coffee. So it's a direct line of communication.
Mm-hmm.
But what I love about them is their sort of quirky sense of humor. And again, very much about the community. You know, it's outside of Detroit. It's a car culture. They bought an old trailer on one of those sort of round, I forget the exact, I want to say Airstream, but it's not, like a roadster trailer. And they turned it into a coffee pot. They put a handle and a spout on it. They serve coffee and brown sugar donuts out of this trailer in a parking lot outside of their Roadhouse restaurant. Very much a part of who they are.
And the last one?
Now, the last one is on a par, I would say, with La Colombe in size. And these people, Intelligentsia in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
spend about 5 months of the year actually sourcing their beans. And they work with farmers in the tropics to grow the bean according to their specification. And they often, like when you see a bag of their coffee, some of the bags in which the coffee comes, you'll see it's a joint project between a certain farm and Intelligentsia.
Huh.
You know, you fall in love with your own style of coffee. You know, people are very idiosyncratic about the coffee that they drink. And so this is the anti-corporate coffee.
I love it. Francine, thank you.
Oh, sure, Lynn.
Food writer and columnist Francine Marukian is author of Esquire Eats, How to Feed Your Friends and Lovers. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what color is the latest trendsetter in the food world? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/SuperTarget. Well, now we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what color is the latest trendsetter, at least on two continents? Well, actually, it's the absence of color. I'm talking about black. Now, from over a year ago, when our reporter Scott Haas introduced us to the Blind Cow restaurant in Zurich, where you eat in pitch darkness, the trend has spread. There are dark restaurants in Paris and Berlin, London, Sydney and Melbourne, and experiments in New York and L.A. And in many cases, the reviews are good. More important, I think, is the experience. I mean, without sight, our senses and our grasp of the safe and familiar probably ride the teeter-totter. I mean, what you taste and feel may not be at all what you expect. Now, if you can't dine in the dark locally, try blackout wine. The Riedel glass people, you know, they're the ones who have these scientifically designed wine glasses, have new black tasting glasses. It's just you, your nose, and your little old taste buds. Lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Mark on the line. He's calling from St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Hey, Mark, what do you want to talk about?
Lamb chops.
Uh-huh.
Been recently going to some restaurants around the town.
Right.
And they're quite beautiful when they're done, but I go back home, I look in the recipes, I go online, look in the recipes, and they always say French. And I know, what in the world do you mean to French a lamb chop? And I'm thinking scenes of Sherry Lewis when I hear this, but what was it really?
You mean the puppet lamb chop?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. So you want to know what Frenching means when they say French a lamb chop, French being the verb as opposed to a noun, right?
Yes.
Well, you're not supposed to know what Frenching means. Nobody knows what Frenching means unless they're a cook and they do it all the time. What it means is to remove the fat and there's little shreds of meat from the end of the bone of the chop. Now, we don't see lamb chops cut like this very often, but when they're cut for fancy restaurants, the rib bone that they sit on is left quite long. And what is done is that you shave off all of the gristle and bits of fat on that long rib bone. It usually doesn't have very much meat on it. And that is Frenching. But most lamb chops we see, you know, don't have a long bone at all. So you can forget it. You don't have to worry about it.
Okay.
But it's kind of a nice thing to drop when you're with a bunch of food snobs. You know, if you see a long chop and it has a little, sometimes they put those little ruffled things on them out of paper or foil. You can say, oh, they did a rather nasty job Frenching that chop, you know, or something like that. But anyway, that's what it is. It's when you trim the bone down to the bone, you trim off all the gristle and whatever, and it looks very neat and tidy. And it's a handle. Also, you can lift the chop up and nibble it that way.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, thank you.
No, thank you. Great question. Hey, thanks for the call.
All righty.
You take care.
Yeah, bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Cleve up next. Cleve's calling from Indianapolis. Hey, Cleve, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. The reason for the call is I was recently out sailing in Nantucket Sound, and I was thinking about the proper preparation and what you can do to shuck clams and oysters in the easiest possible way. my brother and I have an ongoing battle about what's the best preparation for shucking raw clams and oysters.
I'm still stuck on you sailing Nantucket Sound. I can just imagine how gorgeous that is. This is tricky stuff. This is tricky stuff, and this is really a case of you find the way that's most comfortable. The standard procedure is that you use, for both of them, something that isn't very sharp, like a kitchen knife.
Yeah.
You know, an old kitchen knife, and something pretty strong that's not going to bend. Now, with a clam, it's kind of easy, because with a clam, you can see where the two shells join. I'm thinking hard shell here.
Yeah,
right?
Correct.
Yeah, not the soft shell. So what you do is scrub it. You scrub, you know, both of them, get them really clean. And then what you do is, with the clam, you can hold it in the palm of your hand, but I don't like to take chances. I just nest it on a table in towel.
You know, so if it slips or anything, or the knife slips, my hand's not going to get cut. But what you do is you try to find an opening, and usually it's not at the hinge of the clam. It's sort of at the front of the clam. You just try to work the blade of an old kitchen knife that's really strong in there. Okay? I'm talking table knife here, by the way.
Sure.
You know, because you don't want it sharp. And you try to just edge it in there, and then you edge it around until you get to the what I think of as the back of the clam, where the clam's hinged. And that's where you start working to snap the hinge. It's not very hard at all. And then you go all the way around the shell. And what you want to do, though, is to tip the knife so that you're sort of scooping under the clam meat that's sitting in the shell. You don't want to slice it in half if you can avoid it. If you do slice it in half, you just carve it off the top shell and plop it in. And that's it.
Great.
That's it. You've got clams on the half shell. I mean, a little lemon, maybe. Not even that. Oh, God, they taste so good.
Try some wasabi on it as well. Terrific.
But doesn't that kill the clam? I mean, isn't that sort
nope.
of strong?
Oh, nope.
Okay.
That
all right.
Terrific.
With oysters, I'd say anywhere that you can get. Some people use church key can openers, you know, the beer, old-fashioned beer openers, to wedge in. The same idea. You want to wedge into the shell and work around, and then you'll open up the oyster. In this case, you often get a lot of shell in the oyster because the shell's so crumbly. And one of the things I learned is you can actually rinse that out, and the oyster seems to just want to give you more of that delicious liquid, so it's not like you're losing all the good stuff. So that's the two of them. And now you can go and start shucking.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
I appreciate it.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Call us at 800-537-5252. We have Hollis calling from Bonita Spring, Florida. Hollis, how are you? What's happening?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you very much.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, about 3 years ago, this time of year, my husband and I were visiting friends in Saint-Rémy, France.
Uh-huh.
And went to a lovely little restaurant, I can't think of the name of it, and had a soup that none of us knew what it was. We just knew it was wonderfully delicious. And the waitress, because she couldn't speak English, couldn't really tell us. So we went through this pantomiming thing, and finally we figured out what she had served us was chestnut soup. And it was just wonderful. It was creamy. It was sort of a light brown color.
Right.
And since then, for the last 3 years, I've been trying to find a recipe for it and can't find one anywhere. So I called you all.
Well, okay. Now, was it sort of like a puree?
Yes.
Yes,
I would almost like a bisque.
Yeah, okay. I have a very good idea of how it was made. It may not be the exact same soup, but very close. The first, you know, this is like, you know, first find your pig, right? First you got to get your chestnuts. And you can get them canned and in liquid. There's also a much better version of them where they're sort of roasted and shelled and they're in a jar and there's no liquid in them. But frankly, if you're going to go to the trouble of making chestnut soup, you should start with fresh chestnuts. And they're going to show up in the market probably in November, December.
Okay.
Okay. And when you buy them, you want them to be as plump as possible. You don't want them to look like, you know, everything's dried up in, inside of them. So the first thing you do is you roast the chestnuts. Cut across in the shell, throw them in a cake pan, put them in a 400-degree oven for about 45 minutes. Okay?
Okay.
Let them cool down completely, and then you can just pop off the shell. There's a skin under the shell, but that's going to have opened up a bit. So get that over out of the way. Now, once you've done that, they can wait for you in the fridge overnight or whatever. So you can get that piece out of the way. Then what I would do is I would start with like a classic French base for a cream soup. I would use onion and shallots in equal quantities. I would use butter. I mean, we're going to do this right, right?
Yeah.
And I would use, let's say, two really nice, one medium to large onion. And I would use two nice-sized shallots or three nice-sized shallots. And I'd do a slow sauté in a saucepan with butter. I'd throw in a little garlic, not a lot, fresh garlic, stir that in. Then add really good, fabulous, wonderful homemade chicken broth.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, again, I want to give you what you had. And what you had, I don't think, was broth from a can.
Right.
Okay. So you put in that chicken broth, and you want to put in enough. I'd say about 3 to 4 cups. Probably a quart will do you very nicely. I forgot one step. You are going to throw some bay leaves and a few cloves in there. And you're going to sauté that with the onions.
All right.
All right. And then you'll add the garlic. You'll cook a minute, and you'll stir in those roasted chestnuts. You want about a pound of them. Then you add the broth to cover. And you cook that for about 20 to 30 minutes. You puree it. and then you put it back into the pan and you add about a half a cup of cream. And when you warm it up, and this can wait in the fridge for a day or two, by the way. And when you warm it up, you simmer the cream for about a minute and you have chestnut soup. And if you want to reserve some of the roasted chestnuts and just crumble them on the top, they're sweet. They are so sweet, I can't tell you.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it's just fabulous. And by the way, if the soup tastes too sweet, you can always finish it with a little bit of lemon juice at the table.
Got it.
Okay.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're making me so hungry. Hey, thank you, Hollis.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. I came across a new line of oils, but they're really not new. I think of these as sort of the lost ancestors. The Torrangel people, they're out of California, are doing all these different kinds of nut oils and one seed oil that I've got to tell you about, but they're doing almond oil and hazelnut oil and walnut oil. And these are cold-pressed oils that taste like the nuts they come from. These have been used in France for donkey's years. And, you know, you just don't see them here very often. And it's great to see that they're gaining some popularity. And as far as using them, think about, you know, if you throw some hazelnuts in a salad and you dress it with hazelnut oil. I mean, some of the uses are obvious. Also, almond oil in any cake recipe that calls for oil is fabulous. But there's one other oil that they're doing, and it's something that's popping up in chefs' recipes lately. It is called grapeseed oil, and it's literally pressed from the wine grapeseed. Now, in France, for donkey's years, this has been the favored oil for deep frying. And anytime you do a dressing or you cook where you want a very neutral flavor, there's a slight nuttiness to the oil, but it has this really high burn point, meaning it doesn't smoke or break down with high temperatures. And chefs love this. And it's very delicate, doesn't have a strong flavor. And it's the kind of thing I love to keep around the house. So grapeseed oil, the company, this one of the companies that's doing this kind of thing is La Torrangel, based in California. And by the way, store all of these oils in the fridge once you open them. But try them. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have got Mary calling from Seattle. Mary, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a dairy-related question for you.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you've gone to the store. You come home with a pint of sour cream. Or yogurt's another good one, this happens too.
Right.
There's a liquid that appears on the top as if something is separated. It's kind of a clear liquid.
Right.
My question for years has been, it's kind of two-part.
Uh-huh.
Number one, what is that liquid? And number two, what the heck do you do with it? Do you pour it in or do you stir it back into whatever it is here?
Okay.
Opening.
Remember Little Miss Muffet sitting on her tuffet eating her curds and whey?
Yeah.
Well, almost all milk products divide up into the solids, which are the curds, and the liquid, which is the whey. And what you've got there is residual whey. And it usually has a slightly tart flavor. And you can, if you want to, you can stir it right back into whatever is giving it off, the yogurt or the sour cream or whatever. Or you could pour it off because that'll just give you more concentrated solid. So it's your choice. But it's not harmful.
Right.
And B, it, you know, if you taste it, you'll see sometimes it has an acidic taste. And if you want to have a little more of that taste, stir it right back in.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Whatever turns you on.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, it certainly isn't your grandma's doctor's approach to healing out there. Hospitals are creating centers for integrative medicine, and mainstream research is being done in alternative nutrition. Now, one center is at the University of Michigan at its Integrative Medicine Clinical Services. Now, they've created a new healing foods pyramid. Well, we have the center's director, Dr. Monica Michaelbust, on the phone. Dr. Michaelbust, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to speak with you.
So why do we need another pyramid?
Well, this healing foods pyramid was created to be a simple, practical tool that celebrated abundance and yet gave people a clear visual image of how much they should be eating of what.
The thing that surprised me about this was the foundation of the pyramid, that's the largest consumption for us daily, it's water. And, you know, we've been hearing maybe we don't need 8 glasses of water a day. Tell me about this.
Well, water is essential, and we are mostly made of water. And that is one thing that the USDA did forget about on their pyramid. So we want to remind people that water is the foundation, followed by fruits and vegetables and then whole grains.
What else sets this pyramid apart from most of the others?
Well, the bottom two-thirds is actually a vegetarian pyramid. Then as you go further up and you include eggs and dairy and then fish and seafood and lean meats as you get further toward the top, it allows for eating guidance for just about any range of choices that one may make. And at the very top is perhaps the most popular category, accompaniments, that includes tea, chocolate, and wine.
I noticed that, and it's even a glass of beer there, if I'm not incorrect.
Yeah,
because there were two things here I had never seen on a pyramid. You have, still in the vegetarian category, and the things that we should be eating daily, seasonings.
Yes. Seasonings have been shown to have healing qualities. Ginger can help with nausea, particularly during pregnancy or treatment of cancer. Hot peppers have been shown to have medicinal qualities, as well as onions and garlic and other culinary seasonings also may have medicinal benefits.
The other thing, tell me chocolate's good for me.
Chocolate is good for you. And it needs to be chocolate that is more than 70% cacao. And so that is a dark chocolate. And dark chocolate is rich in flavonoids, which have been shown to have antioxidant qualities, as well as the good feeling benefits that many of us derive from chocolate.
Oh, Doctor, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Monica Michelbust is director of the Integrative Medicine Clinical Services at the University of Michigan. Now, for more information on the Healing Foods Pyramid, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Fernando Pessoa. Now, he said, "There's no metaphysics on earth like chocolate." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schwenkler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.